World War, and this will be the last part of our show today. The weather looks like rain, highs around 56, southeast winds 10 miles per hour, Saturday partly cloudy, Saturday night increasing clouds, Sunday rain likely.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Jacqueline Estes, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. To ease drought-related hardships, a judge has approved early payment to farmers and ranchers, many of them in Oklahoma, North Carolina, and Alabama. Eligible for a $50,000 payment in the discrimination suit, Keeps Eagle versus the Department of Agriculture. Checks from the $680 million settlement are expected to go out by August 29th. A schedule for other payments and debt relief should be in place by October 31st. Courts closed one day last week in St. Louis County, Minnesota, home of the Fond du Lac and Net Lake Chippewa reservations, so criminal justice officials could receive training to limit prejudice. J.P. Rehnquist from WGZS has the story.
Native Americans and African Americans make up as much as 80% of those being held in St. Louis County's jails, but only about 2% of the population. In 2010, the county received a grant from the American Bar Association to address racial disparities. A task force was convened. Task force member, area social worker, and Fond du Lac tribal member Donna Ennis says they decided to focus on creating a racially blind assessment tool to limit prejudices that may be affecting the pretrial release process.
Probation officers that are being asked to supervise, being unfamiliar with the culture, being unfamiliar with different racial groups, might be hesitant, maybe not wanting to go on to the reservation. And so we're not allowing people to enter the supervised release program for that reason.
All of St. Louis County's judges and 60 probation officers are now trained to use this bias-free assessment tool.
That was J.P. Rehnquist from the Fond du Lac Reservation in Minnesota reporting. In the last in our series on climate change and Alaska Natives, when sick and dying seals started showing up near Barrow last July, some thought it may be the latest evidence of global warming. Johanna Urich reports.
The count that summer shows more than 100 ring seals hauled out on beaches along the North Slope Borough, half of them dying. Willard Neacock from Point Lay says sick seals were a common sight. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration declared an unusual mortality event, setting up an investigative team with Raphael Stimmemeyer from the borough's Wildlife Department in the lead. This was the first such event that involved animals people rely on for food. Scientists ran a host of tests and found no clear cause for the disease or syndrome. This spring, Raphael Stimmemeyer met with Russian biologists and hunters to set up a cooperative research effort. Anatoly Kochnev, a biologist working with native hunters in Russia's Chukotka region, speaking through a translator, says they first noticed walruses with skin lesions 10 years ago.
The disease seems to be spreading, but very slowly, whereas as far as seals are concerned, we're experiencing an explosion of this disease in Chukotka.
Anatoly surprised the meeting with indicating that polar bears had been seen hairless with skin lesions.
And they were always linked to the absence of ice and the need for the bears to swim for a long period of time.
A few weeks later, during a survey of the Beaufort Sea, polar bears were found with hair loss and skin lesions off Alaska. Scientists don't know what is causing the symptoms. Raphael Stimmemeyer goes so far as to say that they may never know the precise cause.
Sea ice retreat, plus long distances travels, plus, you know, not enough available food, warming of the water. You put all of these things together and you suddenly can end up with a new disease syndrome.
I'm Johanna Urich.
On this date in 2008, Hereditary Chief Aurelius Piper Sr. of the Golden Hill Paw Gusset Indian Nation passed away at age 92. Piper was a correspondent with Advocates for Native Americans before the International Human Rights Council in Geneva. He founded the Native American Prison Project in 1983. For decades, he fought to maintain Connecticut's 300-year-long recognition of his tribe and, less successfully, to achieve federal recognition. This is National Native News. I'm Jacqueline Estes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. You're in the middle of Juneau afternoon, and we have a rare treat today. We have live music. Play it. The music was provided for us by members of the Juneau String Ensembles, and these folks are a group of young people who are preparing for a trip to China. And the background noise you're hearing as the thumping and bumbling happens in the studio is because we are moving our spokespersons into place to tell you a little bit about this upcoming thing. So you heard Forrest Kobayashi. I think you were playing first violin, right,
yep.
Forrest? And the second violin was Elias Antara.
Antea,
sorry about that. And cellist was James Cheng, and Mr. Shaw was sitting in for Henry Cheng, who normally is the other violinist in the quartet. So this is a quartet out of a group of musicians that's much larger. How many are you taking to China, or trying to take to China?
Well, we're trying to take...
And our spokesperson is...
Yeah, my name's Diane Antea.
Okay.
I'm a board member and a proud parent of one of these young musicians.
And you certainly have reason to be proud.
Yeah, they sound fantastic?
They do. They sound wonderful.
Yeah, well, we have Mr. Shaw to thank for that and their individual efforts as well. So.
Uh-huh.
My name's Diane, and we are trying to take 23 young musicians from Juneau, all the way from Juneau to Beijing, Shanghai, and two other cities in China next summer.
You certainly have a very ambitious itinerary published on your website, I think. You're going to be in Shanghai for 4 days, Hangzhou for, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, for 2 days. And then is it Shan? Is that the
Xi'an,
okay, is for 2 days, and then Beijing for 4 days.
Right, for four days.
So this is going to take a lot of just pure effort to put this together, plus a fair pile of cash to pay for all of the musicians.
That's right. We're very lucky that we're a large organization with parents who are very much involved and donating a lot of time and energy into getting everyone there. We're trying to raise $75,000. It's anticipated to cost $3,000 per musician. Mr. Shaw will go as well as his wife, Mei Shui, who's our accompanist.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 25 members that we're trying to fundraise for. It's a big effort. We have parents who are volunteering with fundraising, parents who are volunteering to get the passports in place and get kids to and back and forth to many places. So it's a big effort. China's a long ways.
We have a couple of other parents in the studio, I think, with us. Tip that microphone up before you try to talk into it. Yeah, okay. And the same here if you're going to talk. Just raise this mic. Good. Okay. Okay, good. Okay. So were you in on the inception of this idea?
The idea of China?
Yeah. I'm curious how you came to this. I mean, it's obvious that you have a Chinese leader, but how did you get the gumption to say, hey, let's go to China?
Well, Mr. Shaw has taken two ensembles in the past.
Ah, okay.
And as parents we had 6 and 7 year olds when those kids were going, and we saw those kids come back completely inspired, and many of them it changed their lives. We hoped for that for our own children, and Mr. Shaw is a wonderful role model for the kids, and the expectations that he has for them are unlike anyone else that they interact with. So he's a gift to them, and we're very lucky that he is willing to share his country with us and his opportunities that he has for us.
Now, your current musicians are old enough that maybe some of them could have gone. Is anybody repeating?
They're not repeating.
No one's repeating, no.
Oh, okay.
The musicians who went many years ago, I don't quite remember the date. 9 years ago was the first group.
Yeah.
And then the second group went, was it 2007?
Yes.
2007.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the amazing thing. From the group that went the first time, one of those students has went on to go back to China and live there and do a lot of studies there. And these youngsters, they now play for the Juneau Symphony, and they are working and helping us get to China. They are playing every Sunday with Mr. Shaw at the Jack, and their tips are going to send these youngsters to China.
Okay.
The reason I defer to Diane is because I'm one of the parents.
And you are?
My name is Mary Ellefson, and my son, Arnie Ellefson Carnes, is also a member of the ensemble. And I just kind of wanted to echo what Diane said and say that when you talked about the sum of money that we need to raise, first of all, we are really, really grateful for the support of individuals and businesses in this community that have already helped us out. And as many of you have read or seen, we're really proud of our young musicians. We've been busking all summer, playing in groups of three on the streets with their Juno String Ensemble blue T-shirts, playing a variety of music, and it's been so lovely and wonderful to share our music with the tourists. And our hope was that as we looked at a sort of a diversified funding base for this trip, and we have pending grants and ongoing support from the Juno Arts and Humanities Council, which we're grateful for, and the businesses who have allowed us to busk downtown. Our hope was that the young people would share their music to raise the income. We wanted them to be part of raising the money, and I think we're near raising about $15,000 now. Chris Chang over here, our other amazing volunteer who looked at when all the cruise ships were coming in and developed all the permutations for the course of the summer and has us downtown and sharing not only the talents of these people, but we're also able to talk to the tourists. And some of them are so interested in who we are and what we're going, and we can add that local flavor. That's been really important. Chris, you might want to speak more about that.
Yeah, that's... busking thing we've decided to do is brand new, I think, to all of us, certainly to me. And it's been quite a puzzle, but it's been far more rewarding than I thought it would be. Right away, I saw things that I never predicted, these interactions that they have with folks from all over the world.
Okay, now stop. We have musicians here in the studio who have actually done this, right?
Yes.
So I wanted somebody who's actually walked up to a tourist and said, "Hi, I'm about to play my violin for you. Tell me what that's like."
Well, I'll step in. They're actually set up in groups of three in a spot that I've designated, hoping that the weather is nice. It can be right outside.
Uh-huh.
And that we don't approach anybody. The tourists just come right by, and they actually seek us out.
So where are you?
We've been all over. When it's nice out, you'll see us more often. When it's not so nice out, we choose to be in the wharf because you probably know string instruments and rain don't mix.
Rain, no
nor
good.
Sheet
okay.
music and
so,
wind.
You've done this?
Yes.
And you are?
My name's Arnie.
Okay, Arnie, and what was this like? I mean...
Well, it's kind of fun because you get to play outside, and you don't usually get to play outside for people.
How does the audience... when you're playing, you can see how they're reacting to you, right?
Yeah.
Do they seem surprised or pleased, or what kind of reaction do you get?
They usually seem happy and enjoying the music.
Uh-huh. And then the purpose of this is to raise some money. So then do you have, what do? Pass the can or how does that work?
No, they just put some money in this can thingy.
Oh, okay.
In
so
front
you,
of a sign.
The can thingy, yeah.
The tip jar, aren't
you?
Oh.
The tip jar, okay. And this young lady here has also done this thing? Okay,
mm-hmm.
And your name is?
Kalia Haddett.
Okay, Kalia. So when you've done this this business, do you say anything to them about, do you point out that where they can put their money or anything like that?
They usually ask when we're going and the time, the day, the month.
Oh, so there's some kind of sign that says that this is because you're going to
yeah.
China. Okay. And then they dig into their wallets.
And then they give us maybe a few dollars.
Uh huh. So you get a few dollars from each person.
Usually,
but it adds up. So at the end of a busking session, how much is in the can?
That all depends on the weather.
Well, I understand that, but I mean, what's your big take so far?
Oh, our biggest take. I think we have a couple of members here who, in an hour and a half, our record was $296.
That's good money.
That was really good money. They were floored.
Maybe Kalia can tell you about the one surprise that she got.
No, she got three surprises.
Oh, three surprises?
Oh, yeah. I've played lots of times before, but three of them. Some really generous tourists just walked by and gave me $100 bill.
$100 bill.
Yeah.
Three times this happened.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's because of your natural charm, my dear.
Anyway, absolutely.
So, if someone out there that's listening to us is suddenly motivated to say, you know, they could come play for me and I'd busk them, or maybe not. So they're for hire. But how would you contact you if we wanted to make a donation or if we wanted to talk to you about having the musicians play?
Right. Our website is evolving just a little bit right now, but it's established. It's junostrings.org.
Junostrings.org.
Yep.
Okay.
And
if you go
there,
out there,
there's some information, some contact information.
Okay.
For donating specifically to this cause.
Okay.
And Chris and I are our parents who are helping to organize when somebody would like to hire one of these groups out. For example, next week, the group that started first of all, they're playing
the quartet,
they're playing for the annual meeting of the Alaska Power Association indoors at Glacier Gardens.
Uh-huh.
So they're very happy about that.
So they have a full repertoire that they can...
They do, yeah.
Okay.
They, you know, it makes me want to get married again when I hear them play because they play so beautifully, and I think I was missing that in my wedding.
Maybe you could talk about like an anniversary party.
Exactly. I might renew my vows after China. But they would be a wonderful addition to any wedding. They've played background music at Christmas parties and... Oh, and then events like the one I just spoke of. So they are available for hire. So I can put my number out there if that's...
Please. Yeah.
If you would like to hire these kids, it's 586-2921.
586-2921 if you're interested in hiring the young musicians who are raising money to go to China.
That's
so
right.
So I understand we're going to close this out now with some music that would be typical of what would happen if you got if you were walking down the street and suddenly you were attacked by this squad of violinists.
Well, you wouldn't be attacked because they're not they're just standing there smiling and looking very talented.
Okay.
But can I just say also,
yeah, go ahead.
We have so many people to be grateful for this opportunity to busk downtown, and we just wanted to mention thank you Mount Roberts Tram, the t-shirt shop, the merchants of the Senate building are inviting us inside because they see the kids are getting cold, Invisible World, the Wharf, and Jeannie Canine at the airport. We have many other thank yous, but hopefully we'll get on later in the year to tell you how we're doing on our fundraising.
By all means, come back. I'm anxious, but you got to bring music when you come.
We'll always do that.
Okay, good enough. So now we're going to rearrange things a little bit here. You'll hear some mics getting thrashed around here. I'll turn these down for a second. And musicians are thrashing into position, and I think we're moving music and like that. And what you're going to hear next in just a second here is typical of the music that happens on the street. Wonderful. Musicians from the Juno String Ensembles getting set for a big trip to China, which comes off in a fairly short period of time here. I think they're going in late May of next year, and they're trying to raise a total of $75,000 to support the effort. So if you're interested in contacting them, the website, again, was Juno Strings. Hang on, I got it. Okay, it's junostrings.org, and if you're interested in hiring them, it's 586-2921. They will play for events and things like that. Folks, thank you very, very much for coming down, and I wish you great success in your fundraising efforts.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you. And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 3rd of August, 2012. It's the birthday of the poet Marvin Bell, born in Santa Mauritius, a little farming community on the South Shore of Long Island, 1937. Went in the army, came back home, published his first book of poems, Things We Dreamt We Died For, and then another 10 years later, Stars Which See, Stars Which Do Not See. Went on to teach at the Iowa Writers' Workshop for 40 years. Marvin Bell, who said, "Much of our lives involves the word no. In school, we're mostly told, don't do it this way, do it that way. But art is the big yes. In art, you get a chance to make something where there was nothing." It's the birthday of the poet Hayden Carruth, born in Waterbury, Connecticut, 1921, served in the Army Air Force during World War II, went to graduate school on the GI Bill, fell in love with jazz, and moved to Chicago. But in 1953, suffered a nervous breakdown, spent the next year and a half in treatment for alcoholism, went through electroshock therapy and left to move to rural Vermont and New York State. He began to farm. He worked as a mechanic, hired himself out as a field hand, kept up a hardscrabble lifestyle for decades, and wrote poems about people who live by their hands. In 1996, at the age of 75, his collection Scrambled Eggs and Whiskey won the National Book Award. Hayden Carruth died in 2008 after complications from a stroke. It's the birthday of the journalist and war correspondent Ernie Pyle, Ernest Taylor Pyle, born near Dana, Indiana, 1900, went to Indiana University, went to work on the Washington Daily News, where he was unhappy sitting behind a desk, so he and his wife packed up their Ford Roadster and took off on a 9,000-mile trip around the United States. When World War II broke out, he became a war correspondent, writing stories from the front, from the soldier's perspective, won the Pulitzer Prize. Ernie Pyle said, "Someday when peace has returned to this world, I want to come to London again and stand on a certain balcony on a moonlit night and look down upon the peaceful silver curve of the Thames with its dark bridges." But he was killed by machine gun fire on an island near Okinawa, April 18, 1945. Here's a poem for today by Jeffrey Harrison, a poem entitled Interval. Sometimes out of nowhere it comes back, that night when driving home from the city, having left the nearest streetlight miles behind us, we lost our way on the backcountry roads and found, when we slowed down to read a road sign, a field alive with the blinking of fireflies. And we got out and stood there in the darkness, amazed at their numbers, their scattered sparks, igniting silently in a randomness that somehow added up to a marvel, both earthly and celestial, the sky brought down to earth and brought to life, a sublunar starscape whose shifting constellations were a small gift of unexpected astonishment, luminous signalings leading us away from thoughts of where we were going or coming from, the cares that often drive us relentlessly onward and blind us to such flickering intervals when moments are released from their rigid sequence and burn like airborne embers floating free. A poem by Jeffrey Harrison, Interval, from his collection Feeding the Fire, published by Saraband Books and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. Written by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 29 minutes after 3. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. My next guest is going to be talking on Monday night at Egan Auditorium about human rights in Afghanistan. Welcome, Heather Barr. Heather, you said your parents brought you to Juneau?
That's right. You asked me who had brought me here to give this talk.
Yeah.
Well, their names are Lou and Nancy Barr, and they live at Mile 16.
Okay.
I grew up in Juneau.
So you're an old Juneauite.
I make an annual pilgrimage.
Uh-huh. But now you're an Afghan resident, an Afghanistan resident.
Yes, a Kabuli.
Wow. Is that the name?
Yeah, that's what you call people who live in Kabul. So.
Oh, okay. So, but you're with Human Rights Watch.
Yes.
And you've been kind of, over the last several years, monitoring. You're the key researcher, I think, for...
I'm the only researcher.
The only researcher
for
Afghanistan.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And so a number of your publications have talked about the state of human rights in Afghanistan, with a particular eye to women's rights as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to be the topic of your talk Monday night, or are you ranging more broadly, or...
I mean, I think what I'm hoping to talk about on Monday is what the future is looking like for human rights in Afghanistan. As you know, There are plans to withdraw the vast majority of international military by the end of 2014. And this is really creating a lot of concern in Afghanistan, not because people want foreign soldiers to stay, but because there's a fear that as the soldiers leave, the countries that have contributed those soldiers will breathe a sigh of relief and walk away and be delighted to forget about Afghanistan. And the human rights situation in Afghanistan, although it's still among the worst in the world, has improved significantly since 2001 and the fall of the Taliban. But the reason it's improved is a combination of courage by Afghan activists and funding and political pressure from the international community. So if you take away that funding and you take away that political pressure, there's a real possibility that, bad as the situation is now, we could see it going back toward where it was in 2001, mm-hmm. particularly for women.
So what is this? Can you briefly summarize how life is for women in Afghanistan?
Sure. I mean, as I said, there's been some important progress. In 2001, there were virtually no girls in school. Today, there are almost 3 million girls who are in school. In 2001, Afghanistan had among the worst rates of maternal mortality, infant mortality in the world. It still does, but those rates have improved steadily since 2001. There are female judges, female prosecutors, women in the parliament. The Afghan parliament is actually 28% women. Which is something that I don't know what the percentage is in Alaska these days, but it's possible that might be something to aspire to here. So these have been areas of really important progress. On the other hand, however, half of all girls are still not in school. Female literacy is still below 20%. Very few girls finish high school. As I mentioned, maternal mortality and infant mortality still among the highest in the world. These women who've taken high-profile positions in public life, in the parliament, in government, face constant threats and are sometimes assassinated. And there's a report that Human Rights Watch put out in March about the fact that there are about 400 women and girls who are in prison right now for what are called moral crimes, which most of the time actually constitute running away from forced marriage or domestic violence. And they're treated as criminals rather than the people who've abused them.
Yeah, so running away from a domestic violence situation doesn't get you to the shelter. It gets you in jail in Afghanistan.
That's right, unfortunately, for many women.
Yeah. So I asked you this question before we started, and I'm going to ask it again now on the air, and that is, how frustrated do you feel about the fact that you've been researching this and living in the middle of it now for this length of time, and the change is so incremental, it's so small?
I feel frustrated, definitely, but I think that, I mean, there are a couple of ways that you deal with it. One is by sort of having realistic expectations about what you're going to achieve. And in some situations, what you're hoping to achieve is for things to get worse more slowly as a result of your work, which is a pretty depressing goal to have, but still a worthy one. So that's one thing, is sort of trying to be very tough with yourself about what you really think you're going to accomplish. The other thing that makes me hopeful is seeing the way that Afghan activists have been sort of growing in number, growing in sophistication, growing in the risks that they take and the issues that they push. There's one group in Afghanistan that I'm very fond of, which is called Young Women for Change, and it's a group of young women. It's actually two girls who they're both college students in the U.S., but they're from Afghanistan. And so they started this group, and they've been very tough about saying they're not going to accept any money from the government. They've done some really interesting things, like they held a street rally against sexual harassment. This is in a country where the concept of sexual harassment doesn't really exist. It's a country where the concept of rape doesn't really exist, where the sort of idea that people have about violence against women even being wrong doesn't really exist. So the idea that these young women are saying, well, not only, you know, is rape a crime and beating your wife a crime, but also when you say things that are rude to me on the street, that's unacceptable as well, is very cutting edge. And one of the things I love about them also is we had a meeting when the executive director of Human Rights Watch came to Afghanistan with a bunch of local activists, and they sent a young man for change. They've actually recruited a bunch of young men who are doing advocacy about women's rights in Afghanistan, young Afghan men. And so these kinds of things make me hopeful. I mean, if we have the chance to try and support groups like this, then things will happen. Things will change, even if it's too slow for the eye to see.
So you moved to Afghanistan.
I didn't know that that's what I was doing at the time. I took a job. I went there with the UN, and I had a job that was meant to be a two-year job, but that was 5 years ago. So I can't seem to tear myself
away.
Sounds
like the Juno story. I came here 16 years ago for an overnight.
An overnight?
No, not me, but I hear that line all the time. Your life as a American citizen working for Human Rights Watch and living in Afghanistan, how much of this do you experience? In other words, are you discriminated against? Can you do your job?
Yeah, I can. It's interesting. I mean, people say that there are three genders in Afghanistan. There's men and there's women and there's foreign women.
Yeah.
And so in a way, we, as a foreign woman, you're really immune to a lot of this. People don't view foreign women as really being sort of decent and moral people anyway, so you're not expected to behave in ways that Afghan women are expected to. I mean, you're treated like a man in many ways, and so you have access to talking with a lot of people and being involved in public life in a way that's very difficult for many Afghan women. On the other hand, you know, I wear a headscarf every day. I cover up everything. I don't shake hands with men, except in unusual situations. It's very important in Afghanistan to have respect from Afghans for you to behave in a way that they think is appropriate. So I do that because I can't do my work otherwise.
So after you're here for a while with your parents,
a week,
a week. Okay, and then are you going straight on back?
No, I'm going to stop in New York for a week because that's where our headquarters is, and then I'll go back to Kabul.
Are you working on a major on a project right now? Is there?
I'm working on a report that we'll put out in the next month or two, which is about the situation of Afghan refugees and migrants in Iran. I went to Western Afghanistan and interviewed a lot of people being deported from Iran about the experiences they'd had. So that's the report that I'm working on at the moment. I've come now because I'm trying to avoid Ramadan.
Yeah. Why?
Because it's just a really difficult time. I mean, as you know, during Ramadan, people fast and also can't drink water from sunrise to sunset. And because it's August now, that's about 18 hours a day. And so it's very difficult for people to work when they can't drink or eat, and so it's better just to leave people in peace to get through it. So I'll be going back after the Eid celebration, which is the end of Ramadan.
Oh, okay. And that is when?
It'll be about the 20th.
Oh, okay.
So
it's a lunar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they have to look at the moon in Mecca to determine when it is.
Yeah, okay. Who do you want to come and listen to you Monday night at 7?
Oh, people with hard questions. I don't know. It's I think that it's really important for people to know about what's happening in Afghanistan. And I worry that sometimes the discussion in the U.S. about what's happening in Afghanistan kind of boils down to you're either pro-war or you're anti-war. And the situation is much more complicated than that. And I mean, personally, I went and protested against this war on September 13th or 14th, 2001. I lived in New York City then. I was there for 9/11. There was a protest, a sort of peace vigil, a couple days after the attack. But now what I'm most fixated on is what's going to happen to Afghans and what do Afghans think the future looks like for them, and how much do we really need to think about this sort of idea that you broke it, you fix it, in terms of our continued responsibility to Afghans and to protecting their rights, given what our impact has been in their country over the last 10 years.
Heather Barr, speaking Monday night at 7 o'clock at the Egan Auditorium up on the UAS campus, brought by the Juno People for Peace and Justice here, and simultaneously an old Juno girl coming back to Juno and getting a chance to get rained on a little bit in the middle of Ramadan. Thank you so much for coming and alerting people to your talk. I hope you get a big crowd.
Great. Thanks for inviting me.
Afghan music, kind of keying up the talk that's coming up Monday night at 7 o'clock. Heather Barr from the Human Rights Watch will be talking about human rights in Afghanistan at Egan Auditorium. Quick update on the weather forecast here. We're looking at the rest of today. It'll be rainy like it is right now. Highs around 56, southeast winds 10 miles per hour. And then tonight we're looking at patchy fog, rain likely. That'll diminish late. Lows around 49, south winds 5 miles per hour. Those will shift around to the northwest late. And then Saturday, partly cloudy. Saturday night, decreasing clouds. Sunday, rain likely. Sunday night, rain. Monday, rain likely. It's becoming a sort of a mantra. We'll stop with Monday. I don't know if I want to go on. Maybe I will become depressed. So my next guest is giving a talk, I believe, tonight at the museum. Is that correct?
Yeah,
yes.
6 o'clock.
Alexander Dolisky is talking about the Lend-Lease program, and this is a big anniversary of this program, which involved Alaska to a great extent.
Yes, incidentally, on August 3rd, today, 70 years ago in 1942, the agreement was signed by FDR that has established this ALSEAB, Alaska Siberia Airway, during World War II.
And the program was to supply aircraft to Russia.
To supply airplanes.
Uh-huh. Which at the time was our ally in the fighting the Axis in the Second World War.
The Lend-Lease program was signed in March of 1941, before the Soviet Union was invaded.
Ah.
So mostly the Lend-Lease program was a shipment and delivery of goods and services to our allies, mostly Britain. And then on June 22nd, when Germany invaded the Soviet Union, the next day FDR made a statement in the radio that indicated that the United States most likely will support Soviet Union with supply and aid and so on. And I believe 2 days later, $1 billion of interest-free credit was given to the Soviet Union, and money that was froze in American banks because of the Soviet Union was involved with the war in Finland was released to the Soviet Union. Later on, it took about a year or so of negotiations to establish Alaska Siberia route for delivery of airplanes via Alaska.
So the aircraft that were actually delivered, were they all the same plane, or were they was it a different kinds of planes?
No, there were several models. There were about six or seven models. The most known is a P-39 Air Cobra, P-63 King Cobra, a B-25 bomber, A-20 light bomber, C-47, and a few others. In fact, I just was in conversation with the Soviet filmmakers. They're coming to Alaska to film documentary about this event.
Oh.
And they were telling me, and I knew that out of 8,000 Soviet airplanes that were just before the war, most of them were made out of plywood. And, of course, when they received American airplanes, the aluminum and, higher speed and more powerful, of course, for them it was a novelty and it was a great machine to use, in the battle.
So what I'm wondering if it's possible to talk about the impact of these aircraft on the battle between Germany and Russia.
Well, it's remarkable. In the first 2 weeks of the war, Germany destroyed out of 7,700 Russian planes, almost 5,000.
Oh.
So actually, in Germany, headquarters didn't believe that the number would be so high. So they asked, to recount the number, and actually the number came out even higher. So the Soviet Union ended up to be in the first two weeks with obsolete airplanes made of the plywood, and that was kind of time that they start reforming their military and rebuild their military. And of course, the need for airplanes was great, so that the United States starts supplying via another route to Murmansk and Arkhangelsk. It wasn't only Alaska Siberia Airway, quite early. And there was a great casualties because of the German submarines was in the area and they was hunting for American ships. who supplied the Soviet Union.
Right. Now, the Alaska Highway, I think, was actually constructed as part of this because of the need to refuel the aircraft on their way to...
Well, Alaska Highway started very early.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was over in 1942 or so. So Alaska Siberia Airway, they considered several plans. In fact, one of the plans was to go through Juneau, Yakutat, and so on.
Hmm.
And several airplanes actually landed in Juneau, American airplanes that were heading to Fairbanks. But, you know, then decision was made to establish Alaska Siberia Airway along with Alaska Highway. And that was a clever and smart way to do it because there were a number of bases, not necessarily major bases, where the airplanes could land and refuel or some kind of mechanical problems. And it was a visible avenue that the pilots could fly from Great Falls, Montana to, you know, via Canada, Whitehorse, Edmonton, and so on, and then to Fairbanks. And, of course, the most difficult part, at least in North America, was to fly from Fairbanks to Nome, because now you don't have those, you know, the uh-huh. highway or avenue to fly, and Russian pilots, you know, would, you know, take that portion of the flight.
Yeah, the planes were turned over in Fairbanks.
In Fairbanks, yes.
What's now Fort Wainwright.
Yeah, the agreement was, you know, that basically American pilots fly the planes to Fairbanks. And in Fairbanks, Russian pilots would pick up those planes, and they would be responsible for those. And, of course, there were some difficulties because the Russian pilots mostly were combat pilots. They were not the ferry pilots, and that's kind of different training. You know, so out of 133 crashes, 80 of them happened between
Fairbanks
and Nome.
A lot of women flew these aircraft. This was a whack mission in many ways.
Yeah, that is also another remarkable chapter of American history. In fact, it was, I call this Rocky Road to Equal Rights. You know, yeah, because in I think it started even 1941, some woman aviator activists like Nancy Love, they tried to establish, you know, the, well, later was called Women Air Force Service Pilots, WASP, but before it was a different, the name for the organization. So the woman could ferry those planes and to relieve the man, you know, just who was supposed to go to combat, you know, the man pilots. Mm-hmm. And I believe it started 1943. It didn't last for very long, until 1944 or so. But that was the beginning. If you look at the equal rights and women rights in the United States, that was a remarkable chapter, you know, just a place. But they were not a military organization. So those women who perished or who died in the process of ferrying the planes, I believe it was about 33 or 34, I'm not sure, they were not buried in the military cemeteries. And they had to collect money from donors in order to conduct the funeral. It was an interesting thing.
An interesting difference in our times. So there are two exhibits in the museum right now having to do with the Second World War. One of them is the... Kiska, a World War II battlefield landscape, and the other one is entitled When Over There Was Here. These have been up for a while, and that's the setting, I think, where you're going to give your lecture.
Yeah, we'll be talking mostly about Alaska Siberia Airway, land lease program that is a homeland, the home front undertaking. And it's a remarkable chapter. It's not about the battlefields. It's about the effort of mechanics, nurses, women ferry pilots, you know, just the ferry pilots, cooperation between the Russian officers in Fairbanks and other places and American officers during the war. Because this is for the first time up to 600 Russian personnel were stationed in Nome, Fairbanks, Galena, and maybe other places, you know, in Alaska.
You actually have a book that details much of this.
Yeah, we about 6 years ago, my organization, we erected a memorial in Fairbanks land lease memorial 24 feet high. And Skip Holland was our sculptor. We commissioned Skip Holland to do that. So it's still the largest memorial in Alaska and actually brought great international interest. That's why the Russian filmmakers are coming to film the memorial and other places in Alaska. And then I collected all information, and there were about 20 contributors, you know, historians, you know, just political officials, in a book, and edited the book, Allies in Wartime, the Alaska Siberia Airway During World War II. So it's a well-illustrated book.
Oh, and available, I imagine.
Yeah, it's available in the museum, in a gift shop, and many other places in town.
Oh, okay, wonderful.
And Amazon.com.
Yeah, okay. So your talk starts at 6 o'clock tonight?
6 p.m.
Okay, and folks, I don't think this is a – is this a free admission?
No, yeah, it's a free admission. Okay, I guess it's their first Friday.
Yeah, first Friday lectures. Free admission. Okay, so no cost to get into the museum, and a wonderful opportunity to hear Alexander Dulitsky, and as you can hear, an absolute expert on the Lend-Lease program and Alaska's part in supplying aircraft to our then-allies during the opening chapters of World War II. So I invite everybody to come out and hear you.
Yes, of course. And there are a number of families who in June who were involved in this program. You know, Bill Shappi, he was a mechanic, and actually he was the one who I interviewed very early in the early 1980s on the subject. Ellen Campbell, she was a WASP pilot, and I believe a few others in Juneau.
Uh-huh.
But in Alaska, there are several others still right. with us, in Fairbanks mostly.
Well, I hope you find a good crowd, and I hope the talk goes well.
My pleasure.
Ah, my pleasure, too.
Thank you.
Spirit of Youth celebrates teenage Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live. They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
Christopher Marks is 16 years old and lives in Dillingham, and he spends a lot of his time in the public library in town. Now, there are a bunch of reasons why a high schooler might spend time in the library, but this student is there because he's needed. Christopher is a regular volunteer whose specialty is technology.
Before, I was just fixing computers and having them run, and then we got a grant with the OWL project online with libraries, mm-hmm. and so we're getting broadband and some new computers and a video conferencing system. So I set up the computers and worked with the internet and all that stuff.
Christopher says his dad taught him a lot about computers. Plus, he's already had some college-level instruction, too.
Probably about 7 or 8 years old, I was working with computers a lot, started working with them a lot.
What do you like about them?
The hardware, mostly, and a couple programs. I like working with my hands. So.
Jim Jones works for the University of Alaska in Dillingham and has been helping with the library's recent technological upgrades. He says Christopher has a great aptitude and attitude and helped out all over the place, from making cables to connecting servers.
Christopher, over the years, showed an interest. You know, he'd come over and ask, how can I do X, Y, or Z? And we would explain to him how you can do it. He'd go back there and do it. And he did a lot of that work, and you know, because he's learned how to do that, and we've trained him over the years.
I'm Shanna Sheehy.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org. Brought to you by the Division of Behavioral Health at the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
One more look at our weather forecast. You're in tune with KTOO News, and it's about 4 minutes, 3 minutes before 4 o'clock. For the rest of today, we're looking at rain, just like we have now. Highs around 56, southeast winds 10 miles per hour. Tonight, looking at patchy fog moving in, and then rain will be likely diminishing late. The lows tonight around 49, southeast south winds 5 miles per hour. Those will shift to northwest late and bring in partly cloudy skies for Saturday with highs around 65, southwest winds 10 miles per hour through Saturday, and then Saturday night. The clouds will increase a little bit. There's a slight chance of rain with lows around 49, southeast winds 5 miles per hour, and then Sunday rain likely, highs around 58, southeast winds 10 miles per hour. And then through Wednesday night, we're looking at rain being likely, and the highs and lows rolling around that same range, 50 at night, 59, 60 during the day. So rain for Juneau's forecast. Thank you. On Monday, Jeff's guests will include some folks to talk about the Golden North Salmon Derby and run down on upcoming activities at the Canvas. You'll also hear the usual Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and a lot more on Juneau Afternoon. That'll be on Monday at 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas, but we also broadcast on a set of translators throughout the area to make our signal a little bit better in some of the areas that are hidden by mountains and like that in our hilly location. In the valley in Auk Bay, you can get us on 103.1 FM on K276 AF. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, the signal will clear up a little bit at 101.7. K269 AO is the call sign. Gustavus listens to us on K201 AM at 88.1 MHz. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, KTOO is on K210 AS at 89.9 MHz. And in Juneau, you can get KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau. We're on digital channel 871. KRNN is on 872, and KXLL is on 873. And we stream the signal continuously at www.ktoo.org.